What a train that I am was in, what a train, my Lord, I never see.
Prisoner Peter Collins shares with us an article that he wrote called Negligence and Culpability. This article was written for Peter's own Bound and Gagged Bulletin. In this article, Peter gives an overview of CSC's negligence and where it concerns prisoners with drug problems and or HIV/AIDS, and furthermore, how the Correctional Service of Canada refuses to address these problems in any concrete way.
This is an article called Negligence and Culpability. It's written under the heading Bound and Gagged. It's just a newsletter I produce, I guess a pretty short one, and it's sporadic. The Correctional Services of Canada, CSC, have a long history of avoiding the task of dealing with drug problems, HIV, AIDS, and as a result of officials ignoring the chronic nature of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the prison system, we find ourselves 2 decades later with a huge health epidemic on our hands. We can trace this type of negligence back to the 60s and 70s, where CSC, under a different name, used chemicals in conjunction with psychiatrists to chemically handcuff prisoners. And the result has been that there's a lot of prisoners who built up addictions in prison directly as a result of being given diazepam and other sedative type of medications. However, in the mid-80s, CSE management officials were busy rationalizing their policies of not making condoms or bleach available in prisons. The doublespeak explanations skated around the issues, saying it was illegal to participate in homosexuality, intravenous drug use, or tattooing. Therefore, it wasn't happening. The CSE's "it's not happening here" position was contrary to their other correctional policy documents, which discussed ongoing problems surrounding drugs, sex, and tattooing. It appears from this angle that the motives for their silence may have been a calculated health hazard for prisoners. In the mid-90s, the CSC, beseeched by the activism of community-based HIV and AIDS awareness support groups and doctors, was finally forced to pull its head out of the sand. Unfortunately, the CSC's actions with regard to harm reduction have to a large degree been window dressing and fluff. Initially, they provided tiny amounts of powdered bleach for cleaning tattoo needles and intravenous needles. However, this was ineffective for the diseases that ravage our prison system. When they provided condoms or bleach, the dispensers were often empty for weeks, if not months at a time. Now we are in the 2000s, and the correctional community are still immersed in the short-sighted war on drugs, and they have been as successful as the USA's DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency. One of the many problems they face is that they only see drug addiction issues as a criminal problem, and they think they can banish drugs with harsher punishments. They pay lip service to helping people with addictions, but the reality is they only punish them. Some of the methods they have incorporated to assist in the seemingly endless battle are ion scanning devices, urinalysis testing, substance abuse programs, drug-free intensive support units, and canine detector teams. The ion scanner's very sensitivity is what makes it unreliable. Anyone who handles money gets contaminated with microscopic particles of drug ions, and when checked against the machine, the person rings off a hot hit. There are far too many innocent ways to acquire drug cross-contamination to consider this machine a reliable source of drug involvement information. Another ion scanner shortcoming is that it extrapolates false hot hits from such items as hand creams, medications, petroleum products, sporting equipment, etc. The urinalysis program's introduction has actually increased the incidence of overdose deaths, as well as the number of prison-acquired heavy addictions, such as heroin, cocaine, and crack. The main reason for the increase in addiction and overdose is that the softer drugs, hash and marijuana, remain detectable after use for over 30 days. The harder substances, cocaine and heroin, only remain detectable for several days. Prisoners who seek escape through the use of drugs run the risk of staying in prison longer, not being allowed to see their family or loved ones if they are caught. Therefore, they turn to hard drugs to avoid detection and the subsequent punishment. The correlation between the urinalysis program, overdoses, and addictions is clear to everyone but the most obtuse. Substance abuse programs are generally delivered by a CSC guard who has been certified as a competent program delivery facilitator after taking a short training course. The programs delivered to prisoners are also very short and consist of 6 weeks of half days. Obviously, facilitator credibility and competency can interfere with the chance of meaningful information delivery to a suspicious prisoner, no matter how effective or knowledgeable a facilitator might be. I've seen OSAP facilitators, which is offender substance abuse program facilitators, with very obvious tobacco addictions, and anger management facilitators with very limited grasps on their own personal anger and emotion control issues. On top of these present concerns, the programs are too brief, and this is obviously an impediment to meaningful information absorption. These glaring shortcomings are coupled with the fact that there is no continuity of program information delivery to assist the prisoner in adopting alternative coping strategies. The intensive support drug-free units look great on paper, but only if one does not look too deeply at the actual functioning of the units. The immediate problems that present themselves are that the unit does not accept people with drug problems. If you demonstrate that you do not have control over an addiction by urinating dirty or being deemed under the influence, you are removed from the unit. If you are on the methadone program, you're not allowed in the unit. So essentially, the only people allowed in the units are those without drug problems. It would appear that the units are stocked with non-drug users so that when they urinate clean, it will assist in the statistical spin that will be pulled out to demonstrate how effective they have been in addressing various people's addiction problems. Finally, they do not offer any incentive for prisoners to work toward maintaining a drug-free lifestyle. For instance, there is no, after a year being drug-free, you won't be supported for parole. You can't automatically count on a reward for that effort. The canine unit is a difficult one to quantify. Since the 9/11 tragedy, the law enforcement demand for working dogs has blossomed beyond what the industry is capable of effectively producing. It would appear that market forces have decreased competency standards for the canine units. In the case of the CSC, the handler, a CSC guard, receives a dog and limited training, and the team is unleashed upon the visitors of prisoners. In our prison, the handler keeps the dog either in his van or in a small cage with no roof, and there's always feces, and he has to urinate in the little cage, you know, and he stays there by himself, so we hear him howling all the time. And it's my understanding that the very first thing you do when you're training a dog is give it manners and basic behavior, and incessant barking is either a sign of a poorly trained dog or a dog that's under stress and being poorly treated. The canine methodology used at the prison compared to the methods used at international airports is vastly different. At the airports, the handler walks the dog past the luggage or people, but at the prison, the handler will dump all your clothes and belongings out on the floor and bring the dog around and around and around, and he uses this method with people as well. And when or if the dog sits, they consider that to be a hit. However, the more often than not, it would appear that the dog is either tired of the game with no results and sits out of resignation or frustration. I used to train dogs, and I know that my own dog was able to smell the scent of a gun immediately. If somebody came within anywhere close to us, he would alert me that they had a gun right away. So I know the power of a well-trained dog, and this one doesn't appear to be one. So some of the other peripheral steps that have been taken to eradicate drugs from the prison environment have included restricting arts and craft hobbies. prison officials mistakenly link hobbycraft activities to drug financing. The reality is, however, that any drug trade does not use leather wallets, glass paintings, and drawings as currency. I mean, there's no drug lords with a warehouse full of, handmade leather wallets. What would they do with them? So the restrictions have only served to reduce the constructive opportunities that prisoners need to break the stultifying boredom. It's clear that without positive and personally rewarding activities that assist in the development of discipline and skill building, prisoners will more likely succumb to the spirit-crushing boredom that endless hours in a cell produces. The resulting fallout from ion scanner hot hits, positive tests on the urinalysis program, or a bad report from one of the six-week substance abuse programs, or if one of the dogs sits in front of your visitor, can be that they lose parole, they lose halfway house or transfer support, they can be increased in security, lose their private family visits and regular visits. The files of prisoners are filled with negative information that reflects upon future reports and documents generated by psychologists, psychiatrists, and case management and parole officers. The family and loved ones and friends also begin to accumulate negative information on government files that are kept on them regarding their suitability as a person to visit a prisoner. The drug problem has essentially become a witch hunt. The system targets prisoners and family members and other visitors with a multi-pronged attack that ends with final blows of allegations and innuendo. The Internal Security Office, IPSO, is completely comfortable undermining family contact and release opportunities based on pseudo-charges. And in Canada's prisons, if you listen to correctional officials, almost everyone is a drug dealer or a user. Yeah, there's some drugs in Canada's prisons, but having served 20 years inside, I'm in total disagreement with the amount that officials suggest. I find the sustained effort to deal with the issues at hand both cynical and agenda-driven. It would appear that the only tools the correctional services have brought to the table are hammers, and the resulting craftsmanship will be reflective of their understanding and true desire to assist people who do have drug problems.
We have been listening to prisoner Peter Collins commenting on negligence and culpability on the part of the Correctional Service of Canada in where it concerns prisoners with drug problems and or HIV/AIDS.
Yes, I do. You go down, show your you go to jail, show your clothes. I swear now, I go to Jackson, play down, dice it home. Dice it home.